50.1% to 48.7%. The good news was that we won very strong victories in Colorado, Minnesota, and Oklahoma, in addition to Vermont. On Super Tuesday, Clinton took 518 pledged delegates. We won 347. We were losing, but we were still in the fight. That became very clear on the weekend of March 5th, when we had landslide victories in Kansas, Maine, and Nebraska. On the other hand, we lost badly in Louisiana. On March 8th, we pulled off one of the major upsets of the entire campaign. Despite polls showing us way, way behind, we won Michigan. That victory showed, for the first time, that we could win a large, industrialized state with a diverse population. March 15th was a very bad day for us. Despite very close losses in Missouri and Illinois, we lost all five states that were up that day. March 22nd was much better. We won Idaho in landslide proportion with a victory of 78% to 21%. If you can believe it, we did even better in Utah, where we won with 79% of the vote. The Arizona primary also took place on that day. We worked very hard in Arizona, and I thought we had a good shot to win there. We didn't, and I still don't know why. One thing I do know was that the voting process in Arizona was an absolute disaster and an embarrassment to American democracy. People in some parts of the state were forced to wait up to 5 hours to cast a ballot. Nobody can ever really know which candidate was hurt more by this travesty, but I don't think it helped us. Many of Clinton's supporters were older and voted by mail. Most of our supporters came out on Election Day with the obvious expectation that they would be allowed to vote in a reasonable period of time. On March 26th, we won major landslide victories. We won Alaska with 82% of the vote. We won Hawaii with 71%. Needless to say, Jane, who had campaigned in both of those states, was pretty excited. Our biggest state victory of the day was the state of Washington, where we received almost 73% of the vote. Yes, we were celebrating on the plane on the night of March 26th. What a strange and unprecedented campaign. Hillary Clinton, the candidate whom the pundits had determined, was the odds-on favorite. The candidate who had been anointed by the entire establishment was winning, but at the same time was losing state after state by huge margins. We were more than aware that we were behind in both the popular vote and the delegate count, especially with the superdelegates who were always being counted by the media, despite not having voted yet. But victories like the ones we were winning strengthened our resolve. We were going to continue this fight. We were going to take it all the way to the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. We were not going to give up. And the good news continued. On April 5th, we won the Wisconsin primary with almost 57% of the vote. And on April 9th, we won the Wyoming caucus with 56%. We had now won 7 primaries and caucuses in a row. The Clinton team was not happy. We were ecstatic. According to all of the experts, this nominating process was supposed to have ended a long time before, and here we were winning state after state. Everybody knew that the major showdown yet to come was New York State, which held its primary on April 19th. This, as the media pointed out, was going to be a very tough state for us. It was Hillary Clinton's home state, and where she had been elected twice as a U.S. senator. She was universally known in New York and popular. Further, New York State's election laws were antiquated and reactionary. In a state generally considered to be progressive, the political elite in New York, Democrats and Republicans, had created a system that made it hard for people to vote and where, as a result, voter turnout was very low. New York State had a closed primary, which meant that the 3 million New Yorkers who had registered as independents could not participate. All of these people were disenfranchised from selecting the Democratic or Republican candidate for president of the United States. Further, one had to change party registration in October 2015, 6 months in advance, to be eligible to vote in the primary. This was, on the surface, an absurd and undemocratic process. Its major goal was to keep voter turnout low and protect incumbents. This closed primary process was especially bad for us. As the longest-serving independent in the history of the U.S. Congress, I always did well with independent voters. In this election, they would not be able to vote. Further, many of the young people who are flocking to our campaign had not registered as Democrats and had certainly not changed their registration 6 months before. They also would not be able to participate. On top of all that, we were taking on the political machines of the governor, virtually all the state's members of Congress, and New York's two senators. This was not going to be an easy fight, but we jumped in with both feet, and I am very proud of the campaign our team ran. Our strategy for New York was not complicated. Most of the votes in the New York Democratic primary are in New York City, so we were going to have to spend a lot of time there and do everything we could to bring out our vote. But we were not going to ignore upstate New York. We had to get out there as well. On March 31st, we held a rally in the South Bronx. This is one of the poorest parts of the city and heavily minority. The crime rate is high, voter turnout is low, housing conditions are deplorable, the asthma rate among children is terrible. Nobody could remember the last time that a presidential candidate held a rally in that neighborhood. The police department was worried about a disturbance, and they threatened to limit the number of people in attendance. The Secret Service was also very nervous. That evening turned out to be one of the most beautiful events of the entire campaign. More than 18,000 people showed up. Black and white, Latino, virtually all working class. Rosario Dawson and Spike Lee made the introductory remarks. We were off to a great start in New York. What I remember most about the New York campaign were the unbelievable turnouts that we were seeing. On April 13th, we did a rally at Washington Square Park in Lower Manhattan. The official count was over 27,000. We were told that it was the largest political event ever at that iconic location. People there were even looking out of windows in the buildings across from the park. A few days later, we held an even larger event in Prospect Park with over 28,000 people showing up. Danny DeVito and Tulsi Gabbard did the introductions. We did low-key or unannounced gatherings throughout the city, and large crowds inevitably gathered. One of the fun events that we did in New York City was on the street where I grew up, East 26th Street in Brooklyn. We closed off the entire street outside of my old apartment house, and 1,000 people came. Hillary Clinton may have been New York senator, but I was the candidate born in Brooklyn, and I wanted people to know that. We did not ignore upstate New York. We did large rallies in Syracuse, Albany, Buffalo, Rochester, Poughkeepsie, and Binghamton. When we were in Poughkeepsie, we dropped into the home where FDR was born and where he is buried in Hyde Park. On April 15th, we took a slight detour from New York politics. Weeks before, I had been invited to attend a major conference at the Vatican that dealt with the need to create a moral economy. Despite the pressure of the campaign, I decided to attend, if only for a day. I am a big fan of Pope Francis and strongly supported his call for a radical change in international economic priorities. The Washington Post reported, and I quote, "Senator Bernie Sanders told a Vatican conference Friday that the global market economy has largely failed working people. Breaking from the U.S. campaign trail to deliver a talk on his signature issue of income inequality on an international stage, quote, at a time when so few have so much and so many have so little, we must reject the foundations of this contemporary economy as immoral and unsustainable, Sanders said. The address to a prestigious Vatican academy that is nonetheless obscure to most Americans put Sanders in the company of leftist thinkers and political leaders. Sanders slipped comfortably into the lexicon of European and South American socialist and leftist politics, including the socialist government models of Scandinavia. He told the groups that failed and crumbling public schools and annual college tuition priced above the annual wages of many Americans are marks of failure." End of quote. While at the Vatican, Jane and I had the opportunity to briefly chat with the Pope, a true honor. We spent the night in the building where the Pope lived, in separate rooms, as was required. Defeating Clinton in New York would have been a major boost to our campaign, but it wasn't to be. We worked very hard there and ran an excellent campaign, but there were just too many obstacles in our way. Clinton beat us there 58% to 42%. We did very poorly in New York City. We won almost all of upstate New York. In the two New York counties that border Vermont, where people knew me best, we won more than 73% of the vote. A week later, on April 26th, we lost four out of the five states that were up on that day, Delaware, Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Connecticut. Our only victory was in Rhode Island. But on May 3rd, we won a surprise victory in Indiana, and in the following weeks, we won victories in West Virginia and Oregon. Our campaign was many things, but we were not dumb, and we knew how to count. We were more than aware that we had only 46% of the pledged delegates, virtually no superdelegates, and that the primary and caucus process was grinding toward an end. And every day, we were being asked by the media, "Why don't you drop out? You can't win." At this point, our strategy was pretty simple. It had to do with momentum and showing the Democratic convention who the stronger candidate was against Donald Trump, who by this time we knew would be the Republican nominee. And that all came down to the last day of the state primary and caucus elections, June 7th, 2016. On that day, California, New Jersey, New Mexico, South Dakota, North Dakota, and Montana were voting. If we could win big on that day, especially in California, we would be going into the convention with incredible energy that we believed would turn into delegate votes. Further, virtually all of the national and state polls were showing us doing much better against Trump than Clinton was doing. If the Democrats wanted to win in November, our hope was that many of the superdelegates would begin to understand that we were the campaign to make that happen. Jeff, Jane, Tad, Michael, and I reflected on how we could best deal with California, the largest state in our country. The answer became pretty clear. We would barnstorm the state in a way that no other presidential candidate had ever done. I announced that I hoped to have rallies bringing out at least 200,000 people in California between mid-May and early June. That is a lot of people and a lot of work, but we did it. On May 9th, we started off with a giant rally, which brought out 16,000 people in Sacramento. On May 17th, we had 11,000 supporters in Carson City. And on May 18th, we had almost 10,000 in Vallejo. We followed with 6,700 in Santa Monica, 9,800 in Ventura, and 8,500 in Fresno. We just plowed forward up and down the state, two or three rallies a day. By the time we were finished campaigning in California on June 7th, we had held 40 rallies and brought out more than 227,000 supporters. One of the most outrageous moments of the entire campaign took place on June 6th. The Associated Press aggressively contacted undeclared superdelegates to determine who they would be voting for. And one day before the all-important primary in California and five other states, they announced their belief that Clinton had secured the nomination. The AP had determined that by combining her pledged delegates and those superdelegates who told them they would be voting for Clinton at the convention, she had enough votes to win. The day before the last votes were cast in the Democratic nominating process, the AP decided on their own that the election was effectively over. It's not quite clear to me why they did that, but I believe strongly that their action had a negative impact on voter turnout and hurt us. Why vote if the election is over? Our younger voters were more likely to cast their votes on election day rather than voting earlier by absentee ballots, as many Clinton voters did. In California, for whatever reason, it literally takes weeks before all the votes are counted and the final tally is made official. But on election night, we knew that we had not won. We had done well, but not good enough. The media announced that we had lost by 14% that night, far from accurate. After the Secretary of State announced all the ballots were finally counted, we had cut that margin in half and ended up down by 7%. The final results had us with 2,000,000 381,714 votes, 46% of the total. On June 7th, Clinton also won contests in New Jersey, New Mexico, and South Dakota. We won in Montana and North Dakota. The last states had voted, the numbers were in, and it was clear that I would not be the Democratic nominee. But we were not giving up the fight quite yet. If I wasn't going to be the Democratic nominee for president, my goal was to help write the strongest possible Democratic Party platform and, as a senator, do all that I could to see that it was implemented. During the platform drafting process in St. Louis, our campaign had five great representatives who helped begin to draft the most progressive political platform in the history of our country. Our representatives were Cornel West, Keith Ellison, Deborah Parker, Bill McKibben, and Jim Zogby. Warren Gunnels, my policy director, also served on this committee. Thanks to their efforts, we won some major victories on Wall Street reform, expanding Social Security, and ending the death penalty. The full platform committee met from July 8th to July 9th in Orlando, Florida. While the 175 members debated the draft platform and what amendments should or should not be added, the two campaigns were busy negotiating behind the scenes. David Weinstein, a senior policy advisor in my Senate office, who was taking time off to help the campaign, and Warren Gunnels played an active role in the negotiations. While we didn't get everything we wanted, we did get much of what we were fighting for. It was now the Democratic Party's policy to break up too-big-to-fail banks, pass a 21st-century Glass-Steagall Act, make public colleges and universities tuition-free for working families, enact the price on carbon and methane, raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, abolish the death penalty, expand Social Security, close loopholes that allow corporations to avoid paying taxes, create millions of jobs rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure, eliminate super PACs, and pass a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. And these were just some of the key provisions that we got into the platform. We also made progress in reaching an agreement with the Clinton campaign on some very important issues of great concern to me. On the evening of June 14th, Jeff, Jane, and I met with Secretary Clinton, John Podesta, and Robbie Mook for 90 minutes in a Washington hotel room. Out of that meeting came the groundwork, announced some weeks later, for very strong Clinton proposals on making public colleges and universities tuition-free and greatly expanding community health centers. On July 12th, in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, I formally endorsed Hillary Clinton for president. Our campaign had come to an end.
Part 2. An Agenda for a New America. How we transform our country. 1. Defeating oligarchy. Democracy is about one person, one vote. It's about all of us coming together to determine the future of our country. It is not about a handful of billionaires buying elections or governors suppressing the vote by denying poor people or people of color the right to vote. Our job is to stand together to defeat the drift toward oligarchy and create a vibrant democracy. Democracy should be easy. It should be ingrained in the soul of every American. Getting involved, being active in the political process, knowing that your voice matters and helping to shape the future of your community, state, and country should be the essence of our way of life. It should be taught in schools, discussed at the family dinner table, and celebrated on national holidays. We should be forever grateful to Jefferson, Adams, Paine, Washington, Madison, Franklin, Hamilton, and all the other revolutionary leaders who founded our country. With incredible courage, they put their lives on the line to create a very different kind of society. Democracy is the right of a free people to control their destiny. Not kings or queens or czars, but ordinary people who come together in a peaceful manner in order to determine the future of their society. Democracy means that the government belongs to all of us and that it is our inherent right to elect people who will represent our interests. After all, this is what our Declaration of Independence proclaims when it profoundly states, quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. To secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. End quote. Their just powers from the consent of the governed. What in our day does democracy mean? To my mind, it should mean one person, one vote. It should mean an equal opportunity for all who wish to seek public office. It should mean that the wealthy don't have an undue influence over the election process. It should mean that voting and participating in the political process is as easy and convenient as possible, and that barriers are not erected to prevent groups of citizens from exercising their right to participate. It should mean that poor people, old people, young people, and people of color are not discriminated against when they want to vote. It should mean that the United States has one of the highest voting turnout rates in the world, not one of the lowest. It should mean that political consciousness is high and that people are aware and well-informed about the major challenges our nation is facing. The fight for a vibrant democracy. All of us know the rocky and torturous road that American democracy has traveled since the founding of our nation, when colonial revolutionaries took on and defeated the King of England and the enormous power of the British Empire. Determined that the decisions that impacted their lives should be made by the people themselves and not by an autocratic monarch 3,000 miles away across the Atlantic Ocean, these revolutionaries fought to create a new kind of society, a democratic society, unique in the world of its time. We also know, however, that the Constitution they drafted, while revolutionary in its day, reflected the values and mores of the 1790s. Slavery and racism, rigid class lines, and a deeply rooted sexism. We know that since then, amidst bloodshed, struggle, and turmoil, the American people have sought to expand democracy and make it more inclusive. To quote Lincoln at Gettysburg, our goal has been to create, quote, a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, end quote. The abolitionists, not just Frederick Douglass and William Lloyd Garrison, but the countless thousands who supported their cause, fought to abolish slavery and grant the rights of citizenship to all Americans, regardless of their race. A great war was fought, in part, to insist that the nation treat Black Americans as having the same rights as white Americans. That struggle brought us the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which guaranteed equal protection under the law for all. It brought us the 15th Amendment to the Constitution, which prohibited the use of race in determining which citizens could vote. And in more recent years, that's what the demonstrations and sit-ins of the civil rights movement were all about. That's what people were jailed for, were beaten for, and were sometimes killed for. That's what Martin Luther King Jr. and the March on Washington was all about. These were determined efforts on the part of millions of Americans, Black and white, to demand that our government fulfill the dream of democracy for all. That struggle was successful in pushing Congress to pass the Voting Rights Act of 1965, signed by Lyndon Johnson, to finally assure that all citizens of this country, regardless of race, have the right to vote. Struggle brought about the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, which prohibited the government from denying women the right to vote. The amendment did not just appear. It was the fruit of the struggle of the suffragettes, led by such figures as Lucretia Mott, Susan B. Anthony, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton in the mid-19th century. In similar fashion, the women's movement of the later 20th century continued that struggle. It brought about greater rights for women, greater equality for women, more possibilities for women. Women by the millions, along with their male allies, made it clear to all that women in the United States would not be second-class citizens. Voting is a right, not a privilege. How could we have a real democracy when poor people were denied the right to vote because they couldn't afford to pay a poll tax? Struggle against the dominance of the wealthy and the landed class led to the passage of the 24th Amendment to the Constitution, which prohibited citizens from having to pay in order to vote. All people must have the right to vote, regardless of their economic status. Voting is not just for the wealthy. How could we send people off to war to get killed and maimed fighting for democracy when they couldn't even vote on whether or not there should be a war? The experience of American soldiers in the Second World War, Korea, and Vietnam led to the adoption of the 26th Amendment to the Constitution, which lowered the voting age to 18. All adults must have the right to vote. The power of money. We must make our choice. We may have democracy, or we may have wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but we can't have both. Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis. Over the last 230 years, we have made significant progress in making our country a more democratic and inclusive society. We have made significant progress breaking down barriers of race, gender, class, and age in terms of giving all Americans an equal voice in governing their country. In fact, the many struggles to expand the right to vote have been at the very heart of the American experience. They define who we are as a people. Even though we have far to go to, quote, perfect our democracy, end quote, sadly today there are people of incredible wealth and power who, instead of moving forward, want to undo the progress we have made and roll back the clock of history. These oligarchs are threatened by what ordinary people can accomplish through the democratic process. In order to protect their vast financial holdings, they utilize their incredible resources to make us a less democratic society. They want more power for themselves and less power for ordinary Americans. While they don't announce their intentions on the front pages of newspapers, their goal is clear. They want to move our country toward an oligarch form of society in which almost all economic and political power rests within a handful of multi-billionaire families. They're not content with controlling most of our economy and owning an outlandish percentage of our national wealth. Now they want to own our government as well. They want to make it virtually impossible for ordinary Americans to make the changes necessary to improve their lives. Tragically, they are succeeding. Our democracy, the ability of ordinary people to shape their own future, is becoming weaker and weaker every day. In America today, instead of one person, one vote, and equal voice for all, we are seeing a small group of extraordinary wealthy people pump billions of dollars into the political process to buy elections for politicians who will be beholden to them. Further, we are seeing a massive and coordinated effort by Republican politicians to suppress democracy by making it harder for minorities, the poor, the elderly, and the young to vote. As a result of the Supreme Court's disastrous 5-4 Citizens United decision of 2010, pushed by legal organizations funded by powerful special interests and Republican leaders, the wealthiest people in this country, and the largest corporations, can now spend unlimited sums of money on independent expenditures. The result? A huge amount of advertising from coast to coast, television, radio, and online is coming from phony front groups owned and controlled by a handful of billionaires. In fact, in many elections, independent expenditures now play a more important role than that of the candidates. In state after state, in races for the U.S. Senate, for the U.S. House, for governors, for state legislatures, for city councils and county commissions, for school boards and judgeships, big money interests have successfully determined the outcome of elections through their massive expenditures. As I write, a handful of billionaires are spending $100 million to try to win a Senate seat in Ohio. $100 million to win a single Senate seat in a moderate-sized state. For these billionaires, these expenditures are pocket change and very good investments. For these barons of the fossil fuel industry, Wall Street and banking, defense contracting, and pharmaceutical industry, and more, the policies supported by the candidates they elect will yield a very profitable return on their investments, many times over. And by the way, for these oligarchs, Citizens United did not go far enough. Citizens United allows for unlimited, independent expenditures. A donor can spend as much as he or she wants on a campaign, but cannot coordinate activities with the candidate. This is a very inefficient way to buy elections. It would be much easier and more effective for the donor to control and coordinate the campaign if he or she could give unlimited amounts of money directly to the candidate. The oligarchs understand that creating a right-wing judiciary is very important to their goals, and they're spending lavishly to get judges elected or appointed who are sympathetic to their point of view. At the same time, they are fighting in the courts to overturn virtually all existing campaign finance restrictions and regulations, and for their right to make direct contributions to the candidates of their choice. If that happens, if billionaires are freed to give unlimited sums of money to candidates, it will mean in no uncertain terms that those candidates become nothing more than the paid employees of their sponsors. That, of course, is exactly what the billionaires want. The political power of the oligarchs goes well beyond their campaign contributions and ability to influence elections. As a result of their ownership of media, think tanks, university chairs, and political front groups, they influence American public opinion and domestic foreign policy in ways that few realize. According to virtually the entire scientific community, climate change is a planetary crisis of extraordinary magnitude that will directly impact the lives of billions of people throughout the world. The scientists believe that we have to move boldly and transform our energy systems away from fossil fuels and into energy efficiency and sustainable energy. But that is not what the billionaires who own the fossil fuel industry want. They are far more concerned about their short-term profits than the future of the planet. As a result, they have spent hundreds of millions of dollars creating a climate denial movement that has obfuscated and lied about climate change research. They have also used the influence of their massive advertising budget to limit media coverage of this vitally important issue. When you hear about a report from an independent nonpartisan think tank telling us that climate change is just an unproven theory, or why we should give tax breaks to the rich, or why we should not join the rest of the industrialized world in guaranteeing health care for all, are the conclusions influenced by the billionaires and insurance companies who fund those think tanks? Let's not be naive. Of course they are. Often in the media, you will hear from spokesmen from organizations called Concerned Citizens for This or Concerned Citizens for That. Invariably, these concerned citizens want to cut or privatize Social Security, Medicare, the Veterans Administration, the Environmental Protection Agency, or any other entity that protects the interests of working people. Next time you hear from these concerned citizens, check out which particular group of billionaires funds their activities. Undermining American democracy. The Republican Party won a landslide victory in the 2014 midterm elections amidst historically low voter turnout. They gained control of the U.S. Senate, increased their majority in the House, and won gubernatorial and state legislative races all across the country. Despite the fact that every seat in Congress and one-third of the Senate was up for election, an astounding 63% of the American people didn't vote. Even more distressing, 80% of young people and the overwhelming majority of low-income Americans didn't vote. Voter turnout in 2014 was the lowest since World War II. Why don't people vote? Why are they giving up on the political process and our democracy in such huge numbers? The answer is not complicated. People no longer believe that government represents their interests. For the vast majority of Americans, there's a huge disconnect between the reality of their lives and what goes on in Washington or in state capitals. They're choosing not to participate in what, for them, is a charade of democracy. In the real world, the very rich are getting richer, and most everyone else is getting poorer. Is Congress listening? Whose interests is Congress representing? Certainly not those of working families struggling to get by. In the real world, millions of workers are unable to make it on starvation wages, and many of them struggle to put food on the table. Many in the middle class are working longer hours for lower wages. Unless we change the trajectory of our economy, the country's younger generation will be the first in modern history to have a lower standard of living than their parents. Higher education is the ticket to the middle class, but millions of young people simply can't afford to go to college, while others are leaving school with suffocating debt. Many families have two wage earners, yet still struggle to find affordable housing or quality childcare. Many older workers have seen their manufacturing jobs go to China or Mexico, and find themselves barely surviving on wages for lower than they previously earned. Many senior and disabled vets are not making it on their $10,000 a year Social Security, and 43 million people are living in poverty, and on it goes. And what are the members of Congress doing about all these issues? I'll tell you what they're doing. They are out spending a ridiculous amount of time raising money for their next campaigns. And then, once elected, they're representing the interests of the people who funded those campaigns. The corrupting influence of big money in our elections and our politics has always been a huge problem in our country. But today, as a result of Citizens United, as more and more money floods into the electoral system, that problem has reached new and absurd levels. Let's be clear. Money dominates everything that goes on in Congress. Wall Street, the pharmaceutical industry, the coal and oil companies, agribusiness, and the rest of corporate America spend billions every year not just on campaign contributions, but also on lobbying. In Washington, you get what you pay for. The results? The desires of the rich and powerful are well attended to. The pain of working families is ignored. We'll never have a government that represents ordinary Americans until we pass real campaign finance reform and get big money out of politics. What goes on today is an absolute disgrace. That's not just Bernie Sanders talking. That's what many members of Congress, Democrat or Republican, will tell you privately. As more and more cash floods the electoral system, candidates have to spend an enormous amount of time and energy raising money just to keep up. On almost any weekday in Washington, D.C., dozens of candidates have fundraising breakfasts and dinners. That is time they could be spending doing the people's work. But instead, they spend it fattening their coffers. And on weekends, many candidates attend destination events at fancy resorts across the country. That is time they could be spending meeting with their constituents back home, but instead they spend it rubbing elbows with the elite who fund their campaigns. And then there is dialing for dollars, a totally humiliating experience that often takes place in offices set up by the Democratic and Republican parties and designed for that purpose, with numerous small rooms containing a desk, two chairs, and a telephone. The candidate is given a piece of paper with the names of potential donors, most of whom he or she has never met. To expedite the process, an aide dials the number and keeps notes regarding the progress of each call. This country and world face enormous crises. And what are many of our elected officials doing? As part of a corrupt campaign finance system, they are spending an enormous amount of time and energy raising money for their campaigns. Day after day, week after week, month after month. Today, the maximum individual contribution a donor can make to a single candidate is $2,700 during the party primary election, and an additional $2,700 for the general election. Of course, wealthy families can double the amount given to a candidate if each spouse makes the maximum contribution. And then they can give much larger sums to the political parties, some of which goes to or is spent on behalf of their candidates of choice. When all 435 seats in the House and all 33 or 34 seats in the Senate are up for election every 2 years, the total amount a single wealthy family can legally give is truly astounding. and the huge amounts of money these people donate give them disproportionate influence in the political system. It goes against the very ideas of equal voice and one person, one vote. Ending voter suppression. The Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United went a long way toward undermining American democracy, but it's not the only effort that the oligarchs and their political allies are waging in that effort. In 2013, in another disastrous but less known Supreme Court decision, Shelby County versus Holder, the court gutted key provisions of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. That landmark 1965 legislation required state and local governments that have demonstrated a pattern of discrimination to clear with the federal government any proposed changes to their voting laws. Of course, Congress passed the Voting Rights Act law in the first place because many states had implemented laws to keep people, mostly black and poor people, from voting. But incredibly, the court found in a 5-4 decision that discrimination against voters was no longer a problem, and so the federal government no longer had to protect American citizens and their right to vote. Literally within days after that decision was rendered, Republican officials around the country moved aggressively to pass laws designed to make it harder for people to vote. African Americans, Latinos, poor people, young people, senior citizens, people who would, in large numbers, likely be voting against them. A favorite approach taken by many states is, under the guise of protecting against voter fraud, that study after study has shown to be virtually non-existent, to pass legislation requiring all voters to have government-issued photo identification cards. The patterns are unmistakable. There is a concerted effort to prevent people of color and poor people from voting. 11% of eligible voters do not have a qualifying photo ID, and those voters are disproportionately black, Latino, and poor. A recent academic paper analyzing the 2014 election found that a strict ID law could be expected to depress Latino turnout by 9.3 points, black turnout by 8.6 points. And Asian American turnout by 12.5 points. After analyzing the data, the scholars found that Democratic turnout drops by an estimated 8.8 percentage points in general elections when strict photo identification laws are in place, compared with just 3.6 percentage points for Republicans. At a time when we should be making it easier for people to vote, Republican governors and legislatures acted quickly to do the exact opposite. They restricted early voting, eliminated same-day registration, and aggressively purged voter rolls. Not only did Alabama require photo identification cards, it closed offices in black communities where people could obtain the cards. The Brennan Center for Justice found that in 2016, 15 states had new voting restrictions in place for the first time in a presidential election. In a close election, these new laws aimed at further depressing already historically low voter participation could easily sway the outcome of the election. To impact the outcome of an election by making it harder to vote is beyond cynical. It should be illegal. Further, in many parts of the country, it is more difficult for people in minority communities to cast a ballot on Election Day. In 2012, African Americans waited twice as long on average to vote as whites. Some voters in minority precincts waited upward of 6 or 7 hours to cast a ballot. How many people who had every intention of participating in our democracy that day simply left, disillusioned, because we made it too difficult for them to vote for the candidate of their choice? What we are seeing today is, to use Yogi Berra's famous phrase, deja vu all over again. As a nation, we've seen this before. The approach now may take a somewhat different form, but the goal is exactly the same as it was before the Voting Rights Act. Political cowards are doing everything they can to keep people from voting. They're making it harder for people to register and to participate in the political process. The curtailing of our electoral democracy should offend the conscience of every American. The fight for minority voting rights is a fight for justice. It is inseparable from the struggle for democracy itself. What should we do? We cannot afford to have our democracy curtailed because of court decisions, partisan discrimination, and blatant gerrymandering. We can start by demanding that Congress restore the pre-clearance requirement under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act to again protect minority voters from being disenfranchised and discriminated against in states and counties that have a pattern of doing just that. And we must insist that the Voting Rights Act be expanded in scope so that no American, regardless of skin color or national origin or age, is prevented from voting freely, without hindrance from local authorities. We need to encourage voter registration, not make it a burden for voters. We should join other countries in making certain that every person is automatically registered to vote when he or she turns 18. Every person who moves to a new state should be automatically registered to vote as soon as he or she has a new postal address. The burden of registering voters should be on the state, not the individual voter. We must put an end to discriminatory practices that disproportionately purge minority and poor voters from voting rolls. We must stop those who pare down voter rolls with the goal of making sure that fewer, not more, Americans vote. We should make Election Day a federal holiday, or spread Election Day over a two-day weekend to increase voters' ability to participate. Too many people don't vote because they simply don't have the time on the appointed day, and yes, some forget. Neither situation should disqualify them from casting a ballot. And no matter how we structure election days, some people will still not be able to vote on those days because they are out of town, working, sick, or for any number of other reasons. That is why we must make early voting an option for all voters who need the flexibility. And we must make absentee ballots an option for all Americans who request them, with no tests or conditions that unnecessarily hinder voters from requesting and receiving those ballots. We must restore voting rights to people who have had them taken away. Today, a largely unseen tragedy is taking place throughout the country as a result of our broken criminal justice system, and it is having a profoundly negative impact on our democracy. Many states take away the right to vote from convicted felons and do not restore that right even after these people have paid their debt to society. This makes no sense whatsoever. We supposedly want those being released from jail to become productive members of society, but we deny them the right to participate in democracy? An estimated 13% of African American men have lost the right to vote due to felony convictions. That is unacceptable. We need to re-enfranchise the more than 2 million African Americans who have had their right to vote taken away. They're no longer in prison and deserve to have their rights fully restored. Moreover, it is incumbent on Congress, on state governments, and on local governments to make sure that there are sufficient polling places and poll workers to prevent long lines from forming at the polls. We spend hundreds of billions of dollars to defend this nation. We can and should spend the money necessary to defend democracy by making sure polling places are adequately staffed, that voting machines function well, and that however voting is tabulated, there are paper ballots that can be counted and audited in cases where the voting is close or contested. The Koch brothers. The Koch brothers, the second wealthiest family in America, with a net worth of at least $82 billion, are the leading force in the oligarchic movement. Their company, Koch Industries, is the second largest privately run business in America, with an estimated revenue of $115 billion in 2013. It has its tentacles in many areas of the economy, but makes most of its money in the extraction and refining of oil. During the first term of the Obama administration, no fewer than 18 billionaires came together under the Koch brothers' leadership to oppose the president's initiatives and move this country in an extreme right-wing direction. Some of the billionaires involved were Richard Mellon Scaife, an heir to the Mellon banking and Gulf oil fortunes, Henry and Linda Bradley, defense contractors, John M. Olin, involved in chemical and munitions, the DeVos family, the founders of the Amway Corporation, and the Coors Brewing family of Colorado. In Dark Money, her brilliant book on the Kochs, Jane Mayer writes that these billionaire brothers subsidized networks of seemingly unconnected think tanks and academic programs and spawned advocacy groups to make their arguments in the national political debate. They hired lobbyists to push their interests in Congress and operatives to create synthetic grassroots groups to give their movement political momentum on the ground. In addition, they financed legal groups and judicial junkets to press their cases in the courts. Eventually, they added to this a private political machine that rivaled and threatened to subsume the Republican Party. But much of this activism was cloaked in secrecy and presented as philanthropy, leaving almost no money trail that the public could trace. But cumulatively, it formed, as one of their operatives boasted in 2015, a fully integrated network. In 2015, the Koch brothers announced that they and their network intended to spend $750 million to support political candidates and promote their policies during the 2016 election. That is more money than either the Democratic National Committee or the Republican National Committee will spend. The Kochs' goal was to make certain that Republicans continue to control the U.S. Senate and U.S. House, as well as win victories in state and local races all across the country. According to more than a few political experts, the Koch family now has more political power than either the Democratic or Republican parties. Who are the Koch brothers, and what did they stand for? The media often describes them as conservative or small government advocates. The truth is that they are much, much more than that. They are right-wing extremists with unlimited financial resources who are leading the most significant effort in modern history to move this country into an oligarch form of society and to repeal virtually every major piece of legislation passed in the last 75 years that supports the needs of working families. What are their goals? In 1980, David Koch ran for vice president on the Libertarian Party ticket and helped fund its campaign activities. I understand that 1980 is a long time ago, but there's no evidence to suggest that the Koch brothers' views on the major issues facing our country have substantively changed. What is frightening is how much success they've had over the years in pushing some of these ideas into the political mainstream. Back in 1980, they were considered fringe and crazy proposals, and Koch's Libertarian Party received almost no support. Today, the views of the Koch brothers are the dominant ideology in the Republican Party, and candidates all over the country publicly defend them. From their earliest days, the Koch brothers understood that their power rested not in their ideas, but in the ability of their money to buy elections. One of the major planks of the Koch brothers' Libertarian Party platform back in 1980 was to urge the repeal of federal campaign finance laws and the immediate abolition of the despotic Federal Election Commission. They understood then, and they understand now, that the success was tied to the ability of the super wealthy to buy elections. Let us give credit where credit is due. The Koch brothers, through their legal front organizations and with the active support of the Republican Party, won the 5-4 Supreme Court decision in the Citizens United case, which went a very long way to implementing that Libertarian Party plank to repeal campaign finance laws. But the Koch brothers are not through yet. They want to go further than Citizens United. They want to eliminate all restrictions on campaign spending, and that is precisely what their legal organizations are now working on. If they are successful, it will mean billionaires could directly contribute unlimited sums to the candidates of their choice. It would mean the oligarchs could fully fund and direct the campaigns of their candidates. It would mean that the elected officials would essentially become part of the company payroll. That is the political future the Koch brothers and their allies want for America. That is their view of democracy, a nation in which elected officials are bought and paid for by the moneyed interests. In general, I'm not a great fan of litmus tests for Supreme Court nominees, but during my campaign I made it very clear that I would only appoint nominees who were very public about their willingness to overturn Citizens United. I cannot emphasize this enough. That decision is undermining American democracy and moving us closer and closer to an oligarchy. I was glad that Secretary Clinton took the same position I did. While ending all campaign finance regulations is one of their major goals, the Koch brothers are interested in many other issues. Their being the second wealthiest family in America, it should not be surprising that they want to pay less in taxes and hate the idea of progressive taxation. But they go way, way further than that. The Libertarian Party platform that David Koch helped draft opposed all personal and corporate income taxation, including capital gains taxes, and supported the eventual repeal of all taxation. All taxation. The platform even went so far as encouraging the rich and powerful to break the law and stop paying taxes. As an interim measure, all criminal and civil sanctions against tax evasion should be terminated immediately. As the owners of a major fossil fuel company and leading funders of climate change denial groups, they also supported abolishing the Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Energy. Great idea. Let's just put the fox, a particularly rapacious fox, in charge of the henhouse. And it gets even better. Here are some more of the ideas David Koch ran on. This is the kind of America they want to create. We favor the abolition of Medicare and Medicaid programs. We oppose any compulsory insurance or tax-supported plans to provide health services, including those which finance abortion services. We favor the repeal of the fraudulent, virtually bankrupt, and increasingly oppressive Social Security system. We propose the abolition of the governmental postal service. In addition to being inefficient, it encourages governmental surveillance of private correspondence. We support repeal of minimum wage laws. Government schools lead to the indoctrination of children. Government ownership, operation, regulation, and subsidy of schools and colleges should be ended. We condemn compulsory education laws, and we call for their immediate repeal. We call for the privatization of the public roads and national highway system. We oppose all government welfare relief projects and aid to the poor programs. By any rational standard, these are extreme views. Yet they are the views of the very people helping bankroll today's Republican Party. So the next time you see a glitzy ad on television funded by one of the Koch brothers' front groups professing to care about the issues facing ordinary Americans, please remember what they really stand for and what kind of America the Kochs want. Why it all matters. Many people I know are passionately concerned about health care, the environment, the economy, human rights, and a host of other very, very important issues. Campaign finance reform? Not so much. Let's face it. Campaign finance reform is not exactly a sexy issue. But what many people don't see or don't understand is the direct connection between campaign funding and the development and implementation of public policy, including the very issues they care deeply about. Please understand, the wealthy and the powerful are not contributing to candidates and parties for the fun of it. They want their pound of flesh. If they make a contribution, they want action on their concerns. The more powerful entities don't even need a member of Congress to write the legislation they want anymore. They write it themselves. All they need is someone to introduce it and shepherd it through the legislative process. Here are a few examples of what is achieved by money in politics and a corrupt campaign finance system. In 2008, the United States suffered the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression, when Wall Street collapsed. Many experts believe that this horrific recession was precipitated by the passage of bipartisan legislation enacted during Bill Clinton's administration that deregulated Wall Street and the activities of the largest financial interests in the country. In order to get that legislation passed, to repeal the Glass-Steagall Act, which for decades had kept giant commercial banks, investment banks, and insurance companies from merging, the financial sector spent more than $1.2 billion over 5 years in lobbying and campaign contributions. They got what they wanted, and the American people got a terrible recession. In the United States, uniquely among industrialized nations, drug companies can charge any price they want for prescription drugs. As a result, we pay the highest prices in the world, by far, for the medicines we use. The pharmaceutical industry has 1,399 lobbyists working for them at a cost of about $240 million a year. That's more than 2.5 times more lobbyists than there are members of Congress. During the 2012 campaign cycle, the pharmaceutical industry contributed over $50 million to the members of both parties. Honestly, I cannot remember Big Pharma ever losing a major legislative battle. They win, the American people lose. The U.S. has a defense budget of some $600 billion a year. This is larger than that.